Lectionary Lab Live is recorded live in Gainesville, Florida and Brasstown, North Carolina. Welcome, everybody, to the Lectionary Lab Live. I'm John Bayless. I'm here with my Bubba, Delmer Chilton. Say hey, Bubba.
Hey, Bubba.
Hey, man. Good to hear you today. We are here. It's time to begin Holy Week. And as we've mentioned several times, it feels early this year for Easter to already be coming in during the month of March. But it's been an awesome experience working through these texts for Lent.
Yes.
So here we are today, beginning to pay off of the work you all as preachers have done and invited your congregation into, and the groundwork is laid. And so let's talk about it, Bubba. This Sunday, Palm Sunday, Palm Passion Sunday, it kind of depends which way you're going to handle it. A lot of work to be done and a lot of thought about where are you and your congregation? How are you going to travel through this week? So I'm looking forward to the discussion. Tell us what you got on your mind today.
Well, two things. One is we got a lot of text, and we got basically two different liturgies, as we would put, two different sections to the traditional service that a lot of folks do. One is the opening, the liturgy of the palms, whether you start inside the church or like some churches, a procession with palms, and you've got Psalm 118, a processional psalm, and you've got Mark's gospel, 1-11, his version of the procession. Then you go and you march into All Glory, Laud, and Honor, or some other kind of song to start with, and then the prayer of the day, and then you shift almost immediately to then Passion Sunday, because you then have the text of suffering servants and the psalm and Philippians, and then the long or short version of the Passion. So the question, there's a lot of text, and I want to say, John and I agree that this show is not really about deep textual exegesis. You can read that. You have commentaries. There are lots of sites that do that sort of thing.
Yep.
And we do a little bit of that, but with one goal in mind. This show is really about what or how to preach, given the text, the Sunday, and the part we can't really understand is your congregation.
That's right.
We can know a little bit about that. And so we are looking at this like, where are we in 2024, Palm Sunday, and these texts, rather than taking these texts outside of that context. So what are you going to preach about? You can't preach today as a standalone Sunday either.
Right.
I mean, this is Palm Sunday, but you know, Maundy Thursday, Good Friday, Easter, depending on your congregation and their tradition about what they do, you got to think about what you're doing today as a setup, either for Maundy Thursday, Good Friday, Holy Saturday, and Easter Sunday, or a setup for next Sunday, Easter Sunday. And we don't know what you're going to be doing, but you got to ask yourself, what are you need to say this coming Sunday relative to where we've been in Lent and where we're going toward next weekend? How do we situate this in such a way to prepare people for a good celebration of the 3 days?
That's it. You really do. I have finally learned over the years to think of it in terms of it's the entire week, and it is summing up everything we've done in Lent. It's all been pointing this way, and I like what you said. How do you prepare your people for the 3 days that come, and especially for Resurrection Sunday, again, coming from a tradition that really did nothing. We showed up on Palm Sunday, and maybe it was about Palm Sunday. It more likely had to accept Jesus into your heart. And then we just kind of showed up on Easter, and it was a big to-do, you know? And there was no really preparation, no build-up. And I appreciated what you said on last week's show, and it helped me in my preaching this past Sunday, that the tradition of the church for many years was this sort of passion tide the last 2 weeks, and really turning our attention and focusing on that. And I just told my people, boy, we're all ready for Easter, but do not rush past the events of this week. Yeah. So,
yeah, and we have a tendency to want to. You drive by churches, and some of them you will see a cross with a drape or something, but you're more likely to see a very colorful sign announcing the Easter egg.
Yeah.
You know,
and the Sunday, just resurrection worship,
and or Easter Sunday sunrise service, or this or that. And it's just human nature. Right. So, as we preach Sunday, we got, if you read both sets of text, and if you do the Passion, Palm Passion Sunday, sermonically, you got to say, how am I tying these together as preparation for Holy Week, perhaps?
Right.
So, I'm going to walk us through some things from Mark 11 through the end of 15 that pay attention to. And what I would suggest everybody do is get the Bible down, maybe start with Mark 10 and just read 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, and sort of make little notes, because this is the story we're telling this week.
Right.
And say, how am I going to break this open as economically and effectively as I can to my folk, given what opportunities I'm going to have to do that? For most of us, that's, even in the liturgical churches, the vast majority of the people, you got Palm Sunday, you got Easter Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
You'll have some folks, my discovery is congregations either like Maundy Thursday or like Good Friday, but you're not getting many of them for both.
Yeah. True that.
You know?
Yeah.
True that. And let's be honest, Thursday and Friday, we got the NCAA to contend with.
Oh, it is March Madness, isn't it? Yeah.
It is March Madness. My beloved Tar Heels are playing Thursday. We'll see what happens. So I have to, you know, but that's a reality to deal
with. Well, people do stuff, right? You have been here and have experienced. We have the Atlanta Braves spring training camp down the road. It is a beautiful facility. Of course, all the many other major league teams coming through. And so what I've discovered is this time of year, I have Braves games to deal with because they play at 1 o'clock on Sunday afternoons. And at other times, you know, they play all through the week. And people, well, we got tickets. Week, Pastor, we're slipping out early, or we may not be there.
What we got. My favorite was my usher in China Grove, who had a little transistor radio, an ancient 1960s transistor radio with a wire that came and went in his ear, and he would stand back there, and the other ones would have to nudge him because he was listening to the Charlotte 500. Preliminaries.
Oh, you know. Too good. Too good. Yeah.
All right. Here we go. Mark 11, walking through these texts, several things to pay attention to. First of all, Mark 11, 1 through 13, 37, chapter 1 through 37, begin on the Mount of Olives and ends at the Mount of Olives. Both of them. I mean, 11:1, he starts out at the Mount of Olives, and at the end, he returns. And end of 37, he's left the temple, and he's sitting on the Mount of Olives, and he does his little apocalypse. Now, what you got going on in between here, between 11 and 13:37, is conflict.
Mm-hmm.
Now, notice your triumphal entry. He doesn't actually go into the temple or Jerusalem until after, and he goes in alone and looks around and leaves.
Right.
Okay. And so then the next day, he comes back into town, and you've got controversial conversations. You've got cleansing of the temple. You've got these various confrontations that he has. Make note about this, you know, what authority do you do this? He talks about the vineyard story, about where they keep killing the servants, and now they're going to kill the king, and various things, and scribes and Pharisees, all the usual suspects, as they say in Casablanca. He gets the Sadducees and the Herodians and the scribes. And
it's a busy week.
And the Pharisees. Yeah. And they all keep confronting him. And then, you know, they conspire together over in 14:1. Mm-hmm. So you've got this going on. This is the setup of what happens between. You know, you might say to ourselves, I've heard sermons, here they are on one day, the whole city turns out and cheers him. And then by Friday, they're yelling, crucify him, crucify him.
They done turned again him by Friday.
That didn't happen in a vacuum. Mm-mm. Mark's story is of how he keeps getting confronted in front of the crowds. Keep getting confronted. And whether they agree with the authorities or not, they're smart enough to know, being too close to Jesus is a dangerous proposition. Mm. See what I'm saying? Yeah. They keep dropping away until you get Peter's denial and Judas' betrayal and Peter's denial. So that's, pay attention to what's going on there as you begin to proclaim. And if you're going to read both those texts, you might ask, what happened? Mm. Let me tell you what happened.
Yeah, I think that's a great point to get away from the, quote, dramatic shift from Sunday to Friday, is to consider what's happening all week. They are dropping away, the followers, the supporters, and even the surrounding cast of, you know, all the others, many of them villains in the story, so to speak. They're dropping away. And we finally get to the focus on Jesus speaking to God from the cross. I mean, That's a powerful way to think.
Yeah. So, two other things, once you get outside of that, to notice today as you look at these things, and these are what I call sermonic hints to think about over bigger picture. One is what this text, this story in the Passion narrative, is about what happened to Jesus, not what Jesus did. If you look at it carefully, Jesus goes through it, and it's about what Jesus suffered for humanity. And looking at it, you go say, well, wow, he came as representative humanity, and how many of us are aware that the world is uncontrollable. Mm. That expression, not life happens, but SH happens.
It
is there for, resonates for a reason.
Yeah.
We feel that way. No matter how hard we try, we can't control outcomes. Loved ones get sick. We get sick. People die. Economies happen, politics happen, war happens, things happen. And the question is, who are we when these things happen? Yeah. And look at this. Jesus walks through this, and he goes, there's conspiracy against him. They conspired against him. He is betrayed by Judas. He is captured. He is tried. He is sentenced. He is mocked. He is crucified. He is buried. Jesus was not the actor in this story. Mm-hmm. He was the acted upon vast majority of the time. That's one thing to ponder. Where you might go with this is the man of sorrows, as it sometimes says, the man through this. And he faithfully stood through it.
Right.
And then when action happened, the action is God's. That's Easter. For this week, for today, and for this coming week, Jesus is one who is acted upon, the human who stands among us and faithfully proclaims the kingdom, faithfully lives the kingdom. Even, you know, the action he takes in telling the stories, but the action he takes in the Lord's Supper is, this is my body, this is my blood. It has to do with dying,
right,
and the suffering.
Jesus,
so that's one thing.
Yeah, it's in a way, and again, reflecting on our Lenten experience, we've been building a case that Jesus is carefully preparing for, and in some ways preparing all of this that's going to happen. And when we get to this Holy Week, the work is basically done, except for kind of running out the string, right? And that's being acted upon. And on the one side, you've got the world, society, humanity, all of us acting on this one, this human Jesus. And then on Sunday, you've got God acting on and in and through this Jesus, proven to be the Son of God, proven to be the Christ, the Messiah. And in a way, I don't want to oversimplify that. It all requires what we've been mentioning all the way through Lent, and that is supreme obedience, willingness. And so that's what underlays this.
As a text a couple of weeks ago said, Hebrews learned obedience
through suffering.
What he suffered. Mm-hmm. So the second thing I want to notice is Mark emphasizes how Jesus was abandoned by the 12, and the 12 represent us in so many ways. You look at and there's this all. This with the 12, all right? It's interesting that he had three times in this text, he in the Passion narrative, he mentions Judas not by name, but as one of the 12. One of the 12. It's an interesting little note. On 3:14-23, they all drank of the cup, and the cup is symbolic of willingness to die. They all pledged loyalty. 14:31, and in 14:50, they all had abandoned him. No John and his mama and Mark. They all abandoned him. And we think about this ties in with that crowds and what happened to Jesus. And back as I talked about the Luther text at Christmas, the same thing goes here. People say, well, if I'd have been there, if I'd have been there, I'd have, even with the baby, I'd have helped her with that baby. Right. I'd have wiped that baby's butt. I'd have taken care of him. Well, same thing here this week. Oh, if I'd have been there, I would have been faithful. And Luther's response is, well, you are there. Christ is being crucified every day all around. How are you responding?
Where are you?
Have you abandoned those who suffer? Or are you standing with them? Those are, you know.
That's it.
I was just going to say, remembering we have, I would say 10, if you're going to read the text, you got 10 minutes at most.
Right.
I remember a preaching professor being asked, how many points should a sermon have? He said, at least one. I think this is a 1 point day. It.
Yep.
And the point, you got to find that piece that ties together Lent and Easter in this bridge of Holy Week. And you've got to find that one kind of thing. And, you know, a theme like from the gate to Golgotha, you know, something that says what happened in here and lifts up some of this. What happened to Jesus as representative, and people falling away, and not accusatory. Be very careful to say, not be accusatory, but say, where are we in this story? To lift ourselves into this story. And it's very important as a preacher not to stand back and point fingers, but rather to say, kind of a representative of humanity, saying, where have I? Yeah. Abandoned.
Oh, yeah.
Jesus.
Yeah. I have been reading again some Bonhoeffer this week. And, you know, we all are pretty good at pulling out his probably most famous quote, when Christ calls a man, he bids him come and die. But I did a little reading around that quote this week. And it's good. So striking when Bonhoeffer says the cross is laid on every Christian.
Yes.
And as we embark upon discipleship, we surrender ourselves to Christ in union with his death. And thus it begins. And then this statement is just floating around with me this week. The cross is not the terrible end to an otherwise God-fearing and happy life, but it meets us at the beginning of our communion with Christ. Then he writes, when Christ calls a man, he bids him come and die. And so as I think about trying to unify what you just said, the Lenten experience we've had, what's happening on this sort of triumphal, this bridge into Holy Week, what is happening with Christ as he debates and has dissension, and then finally is, you know, they catch up with him, and we go through the suffering and the passion and the death. The cross is laid on every Christian.
Yeah.
And we do have ways we turn away, we turn back. And yeah. I think we have to own that. But my goal is I want my folk to at least pause for a minute and think that it's not straight from the palms to the empty tomb.
Yeah. And that's the key for that day. I think that's the key that we can do. It's not straight from one to the other, but in between, there's these other things happening.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Jesus didn't end up on the cross in a vacuum. And the other thing is that Jesus, not because, you know, I want to talk about his humanity a minute. Not because of divine foreknowledge and omnipotence and I'm not denying any of that. I'm not getting into that. Those are philosophical categories I could care less about. He was a smart guy, and he had to know by just whoever these people are coming up to him continuously with these questions and who they were and what the questions were about. He went to Jerusalem knowing it was not the best, smartest idea in the world.
Yep.
And he had opportunities to avoid this fate. That is not to say he was suicidal. It was to say he looked at what he was called of God to proclaim and do, and chose to pick up the cross that was asked of him. And the key moment for me is that moment in the garden in which he says, not my will, but thine be done. That moment of obedience. And that's why I say from the gate to Golgotha, what brought him there?
There were plenty of jumping off places for Jesus had he wanted to choose them. And not just here in Holy Week. I mean, the whole way. Again, I want to come back to the whole course of Christ's obedience. So, and we've seen that, and we've called attention to it at some point, most notably in the temptation in the wilderness. But, you know, after feeding 5,000 people and being acclaimed universally as hot stuff, and any of many points along the way, Jesus could have sort of jumped the shark and said, hey, this worked better than that whole Jerusalem gig. But no, he... And that's what sets up that garden scene as so powerful for me.
So one of the things is that you can look at this, and the two Psalms we'll read. One is about opening up the gates and let the King of Glory come in.
Who is this King? Yeah.
Who is this King? And then, you know, which was a song of triumph, usually for a king who'd been out and won a battle at war, and he comes in and asks for permission to come into the temple and pray and celebrate and all that. And the other one is a psalm of lament of someone who has suffered, not a confessional thing, but someone who has been put upon and harmed. And he outlines it. This is 31. He outlines it. But I trust in God, not my will, but thine. And this is those two contrast what's going on today in the Psalms is this two different things that are going on, and the obedience to God in both. You look at Isaiah, the third servant song, and the suffering servant. You know, I don't view this as prophecy. Right. I don't see this as Isaiah saying, and there's this guy going to come. I don't know what his name is, but there's a guy going to come, this Messiah, and this is what's going to happen. No, I see this as Isaiah dealing with Israel's experience of suffering, mm-hmm. both in the destruction of the country and in the exile, and coming to a new understanding of suffering, not as punishment by God for one's own sins, but that suffering can be vicariously redemptive.
Yeah.
If it's of benefit to others and in response to the will and way of God. This is what 3rd Isaiah is getting at, that there is not just the suffering is over, daddy's quit beating us, but that there is some good that came out of our continued obedience through this time of exile. There is good that will come for others. We have stood the test. We have stood here. We have been obedient, and good will come to others, as it puts it here, you know. For the Lord helped me, for I have not been confounded. Therefore, I have set my face like a flint, and I know that I shall not be put to shame. The one who vindicates is near. He's not been put to shame. He stood the test. He's the servant who suffers, and out of that suffering comes benefit for the community.
Yeah.
Later, after Jesus' death and resurrection, the early Christians, who were all Jewish and were steeped in the mm-hmm. scriptures, remembered this, and I see it as commentary on what Jesus did, a way of understanding that enhances our understanding of what Jesus did, and that in some way his obedient suffering led to the benefit of others.
Yeah. It is a powerful way to get into this text. Beware, preachers, and many of you have been at this a long time and have probably experienced this, but we have to be careful, especially in our day and time, that we don't simply make all suffering redemptive, because it's not. But it is this unique benefit that you're just laying out here, and there's a lot to the why and the how of, and I do think Isaiah is the one who opens for us this turn toward redemptive suffering. And yes, I believe that the early church looks back and say, well, this is kind of what Isaiah was talking about, not about seeing this Jesus come someday in the sense of a prediction. Yep. But that this is where the theme, this is where the thinking begins to happen. How is God with us? How is God working in our situation? The third Isaiah passage is trying to work that out for a people coming back from this exile and this suffering and all of these things that have happened. And the church says, wow, Jesus has lived this. And in this case, Jesus' suffering does become redemptive. That doesn't mean that the suffering of 1.1 million Gazans who are about to starve to death is automatically redemptive.
See, suffering can be redemptive if voluntarily accepted in obedience to the will and way of God in the world. Not as just because it happened to you and somebody did it to you. That doesn't, it's when you know that to not suffer in this moment is to avoid the will and way of God. And it's not God's will and way for you to suffer. It's God's will and way requires standing up for this other person. I want to tell a story briefly. That I ran into, I first heard when I was doing my D-Men from a Mennonite co-student in my D-Men program. That was a great thing. We had everything from Orthodox and Roman Catholics to Mennonites and Baptists and everything in between, and we all learned more from each other than we did any of the teachers. And I learned about a book called The Martyr's Mirror, which is an Anabaptist book of stories of the people who suffered greatly at the hands of the Roman Catholics, the Reformed, and the Lutherans during the early days of the Reformation. And one of them was Dirk Willems. Dirk Willems is a famous figure among the Amish and Mennonites. It was illegal there in part of Holland, in Netherlands, where he was from, to be Anabaptist, to hold Anabaptist meetings. It happened to be Roman Catholic, but the same thing would have happened to him if he's in a Reformed area or a Lutheran area. They wanted everybody to be the same religion and tied in with the state. Anyway, he had meetings in his home. He got arrested. He got fined. He got warned. And this happened enough times that he finally got arrested and condemned to die as a heretic. Various ways of the story of how he escaped, you know, tying the bed sheets together and out the window. But anyway, it was wintertime. And he went across the ice on the river, and he was a skinny little fella. And the one guard who saw him was not. And he was chasing him across the ice. And Dirk was getting away, and the guy went through the ice and was going to drown. He was freezing, drowned, and Dirk was in a position. Nobody else was around. He could have made the other shore.
Yeah.
He would have been disappeared. He had never been found. Dirk Willems turned around, recognized he couldn't get the guy out by himself, got as far as the shore, and got a limb from a tree that was a dead limb, ran back in the river, shouting for help, and got this guard out of the water. The people who came was the mayor and the guard for the town, and they arrested Dirk again. The one that he rescued pleaded for him, but the mayor said he has been condemned. So they arrested him. Next day, they held a court. They upheld his verdict. They tied him and burned him alive at the stake. Now, Dirk Willems' suffering was clearly redemptive in one way, and it saved the life of this one man. But it was redemptive in many other ways as people looked at it over the years. And the one thing you ask yourself is, why would he do that? Mm-hmm. Well, it was in obedience to his understanding that it was not right for that. This man was dying because of his action. He had fled his own death, and this man was just doing his job. Dirk Willems said, I did not want his death on my hands.
Right.
He willingly went to his own death to rescue another person in obedience to the will and way of God in the world. And that story, I think, has fed the faith of so many people through the years.
Yeah.
And it came from a place that wasn't about forgiving this man for his sins and all of these kind of things that we usually tie to Jesus' death on the cross. It came from a deep place of compassion for the one who was suffering.
Yeah.
And a willingness to suffer to relieve the other one's suffering.
Yeah. Great story.
I think that's what's going on with everything that's going on.
That's it. And this is the kind of thinking that we have to do if we're going to open that direction about this suffering and how it's redemptive. Be prepared for that. A great story about one of my quasi forebears with the Anabaptist stuff going on there. Yep. So I think, Bubba, it's fair to say this week, again, we're not dug into too deep into these specific texts. As you said, there's plenty of resource stuff out there. So much as we've tried to say, preachers, this week, we got to just stop and think how we position and what we say and what we're trying to do. What's the point in this Sunday before Easter, Palm Sunday, Passion, whatever? Considering what opportunities we'll have. And when we walk in the door on Easter, how have we been able to do the doggone best we can to prepare our folks for that experience? You're never going to change the sea and ears, right? You're going to people that you hadn't seen since Christmas Eve. We'll talk about that next week's show. So where we are really thinking about you all this week. Because You've got decisions and work to make, and we believe in you. You're going to do a great job. Yep. Anything else, Bubba, to kick in today for the good of the cause?
I think that's about all I know.
Well, you're pulling for your heels. I'm pulling for my volunteers. And all I can say about this year's March Madness is it's going to be madness. It's going to be wacky, crazy. And if any of y'all pick a perfect graphic this year and you get it all done, and you're not signed up for any $1 million prize, I'll try to find you $1 million if you can pick a perfect bracket this year. It's gonna be a wild ride, Bubba. I've enjoyed it.
It's gonna be somebody who knows nothing about basketball and threw darts at a board that's going to pick a perfect bracket if one gets picked.
Oh man, that's it. Hey, I've enjoyed it, Bubba. Yeah. Not much left for us to do today, other than to tell everybody bye.
Everybody bye.
Lectionary Lab Live is a Two Bubbas and a Bible production. Our opening theme is Top of the Morning, performed by Track Tribe. We go out today with Palm Sunday Hosanna. This is an arrangement for choir, flute, and handbells. Taking the original words by Jeanette Threlfell, it's arranged by Joel Rainey.
Praise to our Redeemer.